I just really think that understanding is the key to forgiveness. And I think forgiveness is really the key to everything.
Absolutely.
And so if you don't understand anything, you're not going to be able to forgive it. And if you don't forgive it, you're just going to be angry the rest of your life. And you're just going to be this miserable, angry person. So I'm just trying to help people understand.
People get halfway there in that process too. You know, I think they get stuck before that even happens. You know, they get to the point of clarity of ultimately recognizing what is happening, but then they get stuck on that part of, well, what do you do about it? You know, where do you go from there? And right. I think what I've seen and what I've observed is people get stuck and they don't have the level of clarity to know, okay, I can see what happened, but where do I go from here? And I know for me, that's where I got stuck.
Tell me about your background. So you are what are you doing now?
I'm a licensed counselor, and now I own a human transformation company. We help people identify the underlying patterns that drive their results, their decisions, and their relationships.
Yeah. I watched a couple of your clips. I'm like, man, this guy's really interesting. Tell me about your background, though. You had a past, right?
Yeah. So I was an IV heroin addict for a number of years. I had hepatitis C. I was on the streets. I was a full blown junkie. Yeah. Divorce, homelessness, near death experiences, basically all the things, right? Jails, institutions. I mean, death, I had several overdoses. So, that was a big kind of part of my first time I went to the psych unit, I was 17 years old. So, I mean, from being an addict as a teenager to my late 20s when I finally got clean. Yeah.
But that's not really what you specialize in, the whole addiction story.
No, I worked
it's always a part, it seems, but.
Yeah. Yeah. I worked in the addiction space for about 12 years.
But what you really specialize more in is what? More like men's relationships problems?
Yeah. And the kind of the irony in that is the way that I kind of look at people's problems after working with lots of different people and different demographics and socioeconomic status is I think ultimately people are all dealing with the same problems. I think they just manifest differently in people's lives. You know, the guy who grows up never feeling like he's enough, well, that could be the chip on his shoulder that motivates him to become a workaholic, become hyper successful. And you know, workaholism is the one addiction that you can have where everybody calls you a success, you know, and that could be the same driving force that could lead to someone's self-destruction and IV drug use on the streets. So
or,
I think
or the, gambling or sex
or gambling or sex.
Or,
yeah.
Or shopping or whatever. There's a million different things.
Yeah. I think we have a tendency, I think as in society to kind of look at what we can see, what's observable with the human eye. But when you really niche down and get under the surface, the iceberg, so to speak, you start to see that everybody's dealing with the same stuff. It just manifests differently in how they cope with it, their behaviors, the results, and the outcomes in their life.
And you help all kinds of people now.
Yeah, we primarily help married men, men in relationships, men either looking to reconcile, looking to rebuild, looking to get out of a relationship, looking to start a relationship. They've realized there's been patterns in their life and it's become obvious that something's going on that is not just random coincidence or luck.
What problem do you see that all men kind of have?
Not feeling like they're enough. Yeah. Not feeling like they're enough. After working with over 5,000 guys, we've looked at all the data and it always comes down to this sense of inadequacy that I am not enough.
What's the biggest lie that men believe?
I think that they're not enough.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I think ultimately as men, I think another lie they believe is that they have to do everything on their own, that you have to solve every problem by yourself, and that, you know, asking for help makes you weak. I think also that they have to perform. I think a lot of us as men, we grew up in a culture that teaches us to perform to be loved, right? That love is something I have to work for, I have to earn it, and I have to prove I deserve it. And I think naturally that, you know, that can breed a lot of internal issues that guys don't know what to do with. And I think that therapy isn't always the most advantageous space for men, because therapy is, it's an industry that's dominated by women. A lot of women become therapists. A lot of women are therapists. And I think as men, you know, talking about your feelings, you know, it can be helpful. It can be cathartic. But I think for, in the sense of, okay, is there a blueprint? What are the action steps? Is there a plan? What can I do? I think that's, in my opinion, I think that's very important for men.
And you've worked with all kinds of people, top to the bottom, probably.
Oh, yeah. I've worked with some of the most successful people in America, and I've worked with people at the absolute bottom of the bottom.
Who's harder to help, the millionaire or the addict?
That's a good question. I would say...
the homeless addict.
I would say they can both be equally as difficult to help based on their level of ego, denial, evasion. Really, it comes down to somebody's willingness, right? Are they open-minded? Are they teachable? Are they humble?
Depends
are they
on the
coachable? Yeah, totally.
What is working with broken people or addicts, that kind of set of folks, taught you about working with successful people?
It's really showed me that, like I said earlier, that people are dealing with the same problems. That a problem in that could originate maybe in someone's childhood could very easily lead to them becoming hyper successful, could very easily lead to them being on the streets and being homeless. So I think ultimately it's how people cope with adversity.
And are all most problems that people are dealing with caused by something in their childhood?
What I've discovered is yes, is most often, it doesn't always have to be directly from their early childhood, but usually there's always something that predates the experience they're currently having. And, you know, there's different kinds of trauma. And I think everybody goes through something traumatic in their life, right? Nobody comes out unscathed. Everybody goes through something difficult. But I think what makes things traumatic is when you're left alone with those feelings from it, when you don't have healthy relationships, because when you go through something traumatic, but you have, you know, a mentor, a coach, you know, a family member to help support you through it. I think really relationships are the best coping skills. You know, when you got people in your life that support you, that you're connected to, you feel comfortable with, you can be yourself, you feel safe. Not having those things makes difficult experiences in your childhood a lot harder to overcome, face, and it leaves you vulnerable and susceptible to a myriad of other problems, right? Drug addiction and, you know, patterns in relationships that can continue. Some guys that we help, they have, you know, they're on their third, fourth, fifth marriage.
What do healthy families do differently?
I think what healthy families do differently, most people think that healthy families, well, there's less conflict, when in reality, there's better repair. It's the ability to revisit maybe a high tension situation or something that is emotionally charged, and the willingness to revisit it and to want to repair those things rather than just sweep it under the rug. I think they have the ability to forgive easier, right? A marriage is made of two great forgivers. You know, I think it's people's ability to want to admit fault, to see where they've fallen short, where they can be better, where they can improve. And I think the willingness to see the best in somebody else despite what their current behavior or even their worst moments might be showing or indicating.
If you could change one thing about the way we're raising boys now, what would that be?
That's a good question. Man, there'd be a lot of things I would change. Yeah, I think teaching boys that they can be multidimensional and they could meet the moment with whatever that moment most requires. You know, I think in a lot of ways, as men, we're taught to not look inside. You know, we're really given a lot of messages that I think can breed a lot of shame in men, you know, when they're dealing with something, and, you know, shame thrives in secrecy. So I think a lot of guys, they hide, they don't tell the truth, and they do these things because they feel like something's ultimately wrong with them. If there is something they're dealing with internally that, you know, maybe they've never heard anybody else around them talk about. I see guys all the time, they're dealing with something inside. They feel very ashamed about it, but ultimately only because they think they're the only person dealing with it, you know? And I think one of the main things we can teach boys is that it's okay to struggle. It's okay to struggle. It's okay to have issues. But also the key to really overcoming those things, you got to bring them to the light. Mentors are important. Coaches are important. Men who have been there before and have faced those things, right? All the things we go through in life, we're not the first person to experience it. You know, we're not the first person to blaze that trail. Somebody else has been there. Success leaves clues. Even the best coaches have coaches. But I think it's really to teach guys how to look inside and understand what exactly it is. Because so many guys, they just look to the external, right? And even in relationships, when relationships fail, you know, guys will say, you know, they become jaded almost. Oh, it's feminism and it's politics, it's the culture. And although I think some of that might be true, I think we need to look at ourselves and understand, well, why was I attracted to that person, right? Why was I in a relationship with that? Why did I tolerate that longer than I should have? You know, I think when relationships end, people have a tendency to kind of paint their spouse or their ex kind of in a negative light, and they negate, right, the fact that, you know, at one point in time, you chose to be with that person.
Yeah, you have a responsibility in that.
Yeah, you played a part in that.
Predicament you got yourself into.
In order to be in a dysfunctional relationship, you have to be dysfunctional. You know, so I think that people have a hard time wanting to admit that, but there's a freedom in telling the truth in that.
It's almost become ridiculous to see how many women will say, oh, he was a narcissist.
Yeah, and it's right. It's going back to the narcissist label. I can't even tell you how many times.
Not that there aren't some men who are terrible narcissists.
Sure, absolutely. But I think that
it takes a special kind of woman to say, yeah, that's what I want.
Yes, exactly.
And recognize it.
Right. And that narcissist label, it absolves somebody of any responsibility. Because if they're a narcissist or they're histrionic or they're BPD, well, guess what? I don't have to play, or I didn't do this. I'm a victim. Poor me. It's not my responsibility. And, you know, I was there in my life. You know, I've been there in my life, but things didn't change for me. Ironically, all the knowledge I could have had, all the labels, right, that wasn't going to change the circumstances that I ended up in relationships. It had to come from my willingness to look at myself and say, okay, why? You know, why?
So somebody asked me recently, what have you learned from doing this project for the last 7 years? And I thought about it for a while, and I realized there's a dividing line between the people who are doing well in life and the people who are not, or the people who recover or the people who never will. And it's some of us see ourselves as victims, and some of us are just survivors. And that's it. That's it right there. Because if you see yourself as a victim, then yes, you're going to be a victim. You're going to be a victim again and again and again, and you're never going to climb out of that.
So many people have a victim mentality and don't even realize it.
And even if you come from a shitty family, there are people who have come from crap situations in their childhood, and they've still learned how to thrive.
Yeah, that resilience factor.
Yeah.
Right? And resilience is something you can't teach people.
Let me ask you something about men growing up without a father. Can a teacher or a coach or a next-door neighbor or something like that really do the job that that young boy needs in terms of having a male role model?
I think absolutely.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think absolutely. If there is, I think, a healthy male in a boy's life who maybe doesn't have a father, it significantly offsets the effects of those things. And that's why I think I'm such a big advocate for any kind of program or system that, you know, allows healthy men to be a part of boys' lives who don't have supportive male role models. Because, you know, you could be in the worst of situations, but having a healthy male, right, who's self-aware, who's self-actualized, you know, they're modeling for that boy what it looks like to emotionally regulate, what it looks like to communicate in a healthy way, what it looks like to take care of his body physically, right? What it looks like to show up and be assertive, to be a leader, what it looks like to actually be a man. And I think for a lot of men, you know, that you look at boys today, a 17-year-old kid, he's got more information about psychology than, you know, he's got more information about psychology than anybody in the history, right, of us as men. So, you know, nowadays I can't imagine, you know, having a supportive male role model in a young man's life could not help him, unless maybe he was unwilling, right, to receive the feedback, have an open mind, and be teachable.
Yeah. It's you only have to be careful, though, because you want that guy to be a good guy, not a guy who likes messing around with little kids.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you definitely don't want that.
No. So
yeah.
Somebody needs to be discerning and careful about their
absolutely
who they let their kids hang
absolutely
out with.
Absolutely. You got to absolutely.
There's too many of those stories, but that's a whole nother talk. That's not that's not what you're here for.
Yeah.
What kind of things do you see? What kind of mistakes do you see men making in relationships, in their marriages?
Yeah, I think when guys have blind spots, they have a tendency to just externalize everything. So everything becomes externalized. It becomes, you know, it's my wife, it's this situation. And what they want to do is they want to go through the down the rabbit hole and explain to you the context and the history. You know, in 1983, when we met, let me first explain. And none of that is as relevant as what's happening right now and why. So I think the biggest mistake that guys make is they have blind spots. They can't see, they can't make distinctions, and therefore they just externalize everything. It's kind of like, I kind of give the metaphor of, you know, if we walk into a forest, you know, and ask you, what do you see? You know, you're going to say, well, what do you mean? Rocks, trees, and plants, right? And no, what do you see? Rocks, trees, and plants, right? Well, let me ask you, what do you see? Now you're starting to get upset. Like, what do you mean? Is this some kind of joke? Rocks, trees, and plants. But if I, you know, teach you about botany and horticulture and ecology, and I take you back to that same forest, and we sit in the same spot in the forest, and I say, what do you see? Well, you're going to say, right, well, what do you want to know? And like I said, I think that as men, we spend a lot of time looking at success as an external thing. Right? It's the job. It's the amount of money I make. It's the car I drive. It's the way I look. It's climbing the corporate ladder. And, you know, and success is an inside job, you know, and if we don't prioritize our internal world, I mean, there's nothing in the external that's ever going to suffice. It's like a bucket with holes, right? If you have things going on internally and there's turmoil within, and there's wounding that you haven't faced or dealt with, there's no amount of money in the world that can fix that, you know? And I think a lot of guys try to fix the inside from the outside. And you can't fix the inside from the outside. You can only fix the inside from the inside.
Yeah, I think loving yourself is the number one ingredient, first step you need to take in terms of being able to love anyone else.
Yeah, and I think guys confuse that. Like, what does that mean? Loving myself.
Yeah, they're just looking for a partner. It's like, well, yeah. You can't even be a partner to yourself.
No. And I see that a lot. I think when guys exhaust a strategy and they've, you know, in their mind, I've tried everything, that's when they start to really externalize. And ultimately, it's projection, you know? It's, you know, she doesn't respect me. And it's really, no, that you don't feel valuable. You know, it's, you know, he never listens to me. You know, the reality is, you know, you don't feel like you're being heard, and you don't feel like you matter. And we all bring things into our relationships. Our relationships are where our deepest needs are met as a human being, right? Our need to belong, our need to feel safe, our need to feel connected. And that's why relationships can be the most triggering aspect of our lives. You know, guys will say, well, I don't experience this at work. It's like, well, obviously, right? Because at work, it's a big performance and you get validation and, right, you're not faced with the same degree of triggering internally that you would be faced with in a relationship.
Yeah, romantic relationships take a whole different skill set than work.
Absolutely, absolutely.
The onset of technology and all the things, these apps and all the things that we're involved in now takes a toll on relationships, doesn't it?
Big toll. I see a lot of people, I even see guys use ChatGPT to text their wife.
Really?
You know, yeah. They're in marital conflict. And
it's diabolical.
Yeah, I don't know what to say, and let me run it through ChatGPT or
it's probably helpful too, though.
Well, then they'll go to AI to, as almost like as a therapist. And part of the problem with that is AI is going to validate you. It's not going to challenge you a lot of times. And, you're outsourcing a process that, you have to learn to be authentic in a relationship. You have to understand what your needs are. You have to be able to communicate those needs effectively. You have to develop the self-awareness, and you have to be able to regulate emotion. But first, it really starts with clarity. You have to have clarity. If you don't have clarity, then you're blind, and the clarity then yields to, okay, what's the story that I'm really telling myself? And let me look at my identity and the person that I'm showing up as, right? It can't just be a have, do, be. If I have these things, I can do these things and be this person. It's got to be a be, do, have. I show up in the relationship not from what can I get out of this? It's not a transaction, right? It's who do I need to be inside this relationship? And you can, just through the power of influence, you can really create an amazingly powerful relationship as a man by understanding the influence that you have. I mean, if you can bring out the worst in each other, what makes you think you can't bring out the best in each other? And even if the relationship, I hear guys say, well, my marriage failed. It's like, well, if your marriage and it being in crisis brought you to the precipice or the place where you finally admitted that you needed to look inside and you started to do some work that maybe you had to do 30, 40 years of work that you just put off, well, did the marriage really fail or did it serve the exact purpose it was supposed to serve? I don't really look at relationships in terms of like succeeding or failing. I think that every relationship serves a purpose. And it's just up to us to kind of see the purpose that that relationship serves in our life. And if we look close enough, we'll see that there's a lot to learn.
Self-awareness is a really valuable skill.
Self-awareness is really the crux, because it's synonymous. When you have self-awareness, that does give you the ability to empathize, because you start to see that we think that we're all so vastly different. People are very similar, right? And if you can put yourself in someone else's shoes to really think, okay, if I were them and I was acting this way, well, what would I be feeling? And what would I probably be thinking if I was feeling this way? And then you start to realize, well, it becomes a lot easier to understand people when you have the self-awareness, when you have looked inside yourself, which can be an arduous process and be a lot longer of a process than just changing my partner. Well, if you just did this, then I would be better. But your partner's change of behavior doesn't heal you. And I think a lot of people, they struggle to see that in a marriage, because when the marriage is falling apart, you have two people whose perceptions are juxtaposed to one another, right? I call it entrenchment, right? You have this person who sees the marriage has these problems. This is the problem. This is what needs to be fixed. This is what, if this gets fixed, this is what will happen. And then this person sees it this way. But part of the problem in that is, well, I'm assuming that I have to have my spouse adopt my mindset and my beliefs about why this marriage is failing in order for it to work, which isn't true. What we need to do is come to understand one another, and I call it reconnaissance. A lot of guys don't know much about their wife's history. They don't know much about their wife's childhood. They haven't really done they haven't asked the right questions. And I think same with women. Maybe they haven't asked the right questions about their husband and what's his past and what was his first marriage like. And, you know, becoming a student of your spouse is a powerful thing. You know, when you just put on the mindset of, well, like, let me learn, let me ask questions. And I think when you're in a place where you don't trust somebody, you're naturally going to react, right? And think, oh, they're saying this to manipulate me, or they're saying this just because they're trying to get what they want, or they're trying to convince me of something. And behavior never lies. You know, if you ever want to look at why somebody does what they do, just, you know, watch what they do, and you'll be able to, if you really study somebody, understand how they think and feel about themselves.
Emotional intelligence is just such a, it's almost like a superpower.
It is.
Especially in a relationship.
It is.
And I think if you have the ability to, you know, we're not all professional therapists, but if you have some of the basic skills and you can have insights into how your partner is behaving or why they're doing this or why they're doing that and what's behind it and what childhood things they went through to maybe cause it, you'll understand them so much better, and you're able to deal with them and calm them down or deal with what's going on or the problems you're having.
That's the breakthrough. That's the breakthrough. Because I see a lot of wives who can't forgive their husbands. And part of the reason is because they don't understand why he acted the way he did. And it's not, you know, I think once they can't forgive because they think, well, if he loved me, well, he wouldn't have done this. So his behavior is a reflection of my worth, right? When in reality, his behavior is a reflection of how he thinks and feels about himself. But it's hard not to personalize and internalize something when you're in a relationship, because it does feel very personal. And that doesn't negate, you know, what he did, but if he can articulate it and he can really explain thoroughly, right, why and where it came from, it provides a level of awareness for the spouse that a lot of times that can lead to forgiveness, because it's, oh, okay, this isn't really about me and how he feels about me. It's about him, and it's about what he's dealing with. And I think that is really the breakthrough in relationships. And once you can get past that part in relationships, relationships can really become 10 times stronger than they ever were, you know?
Especially if there's that, like, just brutal honesty.
Yes. There has to be honesty.
Yeah.
There has to be honesty. I can't be afraid of how somebody's going to react, right, to my truth and what I'm going to share. Because in essence, you're just becoming inauthentic. And to avoid conflict or avoid rejection, you're just going to placate, people please, and you're just going to manipulate the truth and create an avatar. Hopefully this person accepts, or a version of the truth that they accept, so you don't upset them. But you can't sacrifice your authenticity, right, just for the sake of attachment, because you're going to create an inauthentic connection with somebody that is probably going to only go to a certain level of depth and understanding to begin with. And also, you know, you're probably not going to be as happy as you would be if you were truly connected with somebody who really understood those deeper parts of you, and you understood the deeper parts of them too. Knowing your partner's trauma is a love language.
Yeah, you know? That's great.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Can a relationship survive after trust is broken?
Yes. Yeah, it can. Yeah, trust is it's hard to rebuild trust, because you have to let your walls down. And when you don't trust somebody, you really have to let your walls down, in the sense that, yeah, hey, this me trusting this person again makes me vulnerable to getting hurt again. But part of the problem is people don't see that. I mean, even if, you know, your partner's not the problem, if the pattern is the problem. So even if this relationship ended where you said, hey, I don't trust them, I'm just going to end the relationship. Well, those trust issues still have to be worked through. So regardless, the work is always the prerequisite to having a healthy relationship, because if you don't work through those trust issues, well, then guess what? You enter the next relationship with them. So trust can definitely be rebuilt. You know, people don't trust what people say. They trust what they feel, you know, and in order for trust to be rebuilt, there has to be consistency. You know, there has to be integrity. Somebody's actions have to match their words, and it's a journey, but it can definitely be done.
Do you have examples of couples or men that you've helped out? You don't have to give names or anything, but just like how they've transformed themselves.
Oh yeah, there's many. Yeah, of course.
Tell me a story.
I worked with a very successful lawyer, and had everything on paper, and his marriage was falling apart, and he couldn't see that it was because of his leadership. And it was a true polarity problem inside of his relationship. He couldn't see that when, I think like a lot of guys, when we're emotionally dysregulated and we don't have emotional containment, we create a relationship where a woman cannot feel safe. And she can't feel safe because her nervous system sees that emotional instability, that reactivity, right, as, well, you're not reliable, you're not dependable, right? She can't rest in that and trust in you. And so he had a polarity problem in his marriage, and he was just pretty much, a lot of the conflict that would surface, he was passive towards it. And his approach in being passive, what happened is he kind of emasculated himself in his marriage. And when men emasculate themselves in a marriage unknowingly, they kind of abdicate leadership to their wife, and a lot of times their wife will become more masculinized, where she'll develop contempt, you know. And when there's contempt in the marriage, contempt is the number one predictor of divorce. You know, if you have contempt in your marriage, which is really just a disdain or disrespect towards your partner, it's like where you feel an air of superiority over your partner. When that develops and a woman has contempt towards her husband, a lot of times the marriage is very close to ending. And that was happening, and there was a lot of distance. And through his consistency and through the work that we did with him, you know, putting him, you know, working on his inner operating system, his pattern recognition system, his emotional blueprint system, his life timeline system, and his core values system. In him doing the work, you know, he was able to see how a lot of his ways in dealing with conflict, showing up in the relationship, even his own self-abandonment and self-neglect, caused a lot of the problems and opened his eyes. It made him humble. And it also gave him the ability to write the letter of atonement, right? Ask for forgiveness, right? Make the amends, and have the hard conversations that he needed to have and sit in those hard conversations. I've seen people come back from chronic infidelity. I've seen people come back from all kinds of situations that, I mean, would appear to be on paper, this is, you know, it's over. It's going to end. It's over. And people come to us really at when they've tried everything, right? They've tried books and podcasts. They've tried therapy. They've tried couples counseling. And not to knock couples counseling, but, you know, I've always told people, you don't have marital problems, right? You have personal problems that affect your marriage. And marital counseling focuses kind of on this, right? Let's call it a chemical reaction of when you put two problems together, it fuses into a third problem. But if you really deal with each individual and you deal with their personal problems, it's a much more effective way of actually helping people with their marriage. Because if we're just dealing with the collision of your issues with, you know, their issues, let's say his issues with her issues, you're not actually going to get to the root of it, right? It looks like a communication problem, but it's not, right? Maybe it could be a deeper attachment wound that needs to be dealt with individually with that person.
What was the biggest misconception men have about women?
Yeah, I think there's a bunch. I think one of the biggest misconceptions that men have is that my wife will never change, you know, that we're going to enter this relationship and the marriage will be a fixed system, an isolated system, and she won't change. And she does. I think another very common one is, you know, that if I just provide, then that'll be enough. Right? Because that's what women really want, is they just want a successful guy who can provide, and that'll be enough. I think a lot of men, I see a lot of men, unfortunately, nowadays that are very jaded and cynical and pessimistic views towards women that I think inhibit their ability to truly understand why they think and feel that way to begin with. You know, you got hurt in a relationship and now you're jaded, right? And now that's affecting your ability to see clearly. Because the world isn't as it is, it's as you are, right? So what you see externally is always a manifestation of what's going on with you internally. You know, and if you don't look there, well, it's like, well, you probably only have these views about women because you've had these experiences with women and probably more than one. Well, if you had more than one of those experiences, well, why? You know, it's not just a matter of, well, all women are this way. And same thing with, you know, men. Well, all men are this way. You know, there's a reason. And when you can look at those reasons and you can fully understand those things, that's the epiphany. That's the breakthrough. That's where I like to live, is where, you know, seeing the lights come on in people, where they can have that realization for the first time of, you know, wow, I did not see that. You know, I did not understand how, let's say for, you know, a man, I did not see how, you know, my overbearing mother who had no boundaries, right? And my father's passivity and his emotional unavailability and lack of connection with me, I didn't see how that affected my marriage at all. All I saw was I was having all these problems with my wife. Well, your brain is a survival organ and it seeks to recreate the same dynamics you've already survived. So oftentimes people think that they're attracted to somebody, but they're not. It's recognition, not attraction. Right. So you feel comfortable entering the relationship with this person because it feels very familiar. It's familiar to something you've already experienced in your life prior, you know, and if there's a familiarity there and there's a comfort there, right, and it's toxic and it's unhealthy, well, we should probably definitely look at that. Right. And we have to get uncomfortable in our relationships. We have to be willing to get uncomfortable. Growth is always uncomfortable. You know, I think we want to paint growth out to be something that is fun and it's exciting and but it's not. Growth is really hard. It's really uncomfortable. Growth can be very painful.
Do you think, I suspect it's probably a common problem, but do you think a lot of couples assume that in a young love and there's lust and all these emotions that are strong, do we not understand that it's going to evolve into something very different over time?
Oh yeah.
That seems to be a real problem.
Lust, limerence. I mean,
yeah,
all those things, they fade, and it's really the shared values and goals, right? It's trust, it's respect, it's, you know, it's emotional growth, it's quality time. It's when you have a relationship that's built on, a shared mission, vision, and values, a relationship that's built on far more than just the surface. And that, I think, is the hard part, because when we come into relationships, especially when we've had past relationships, we don't realize how oftentimes it gets worse before it gets better. You know, you overcome that lust phase, and then, well, now is the phase where we're getting deeper here. We're starting to trust each other more. Are we going to commit to this? You know, and in order to do that, well, I have to get uncomfortable. I have to let my guard down. I have to start to learn, right, the reciprocity inside of a healthy relationship. And that can be very new and uncomfortable. And so I think that if we're willing to grow and we're willing to come out of that phase and understand that the way things begin is oftentimes not the way that it will be, that will sustain you long term, that's really the place that, you know, the marriage is a living, breathing organism that is going to change over time, and it's not going to be the way that it was. I'll see couples and they'll say, I just want things to be the way they were. And, you know, you're not going to go back to the relationship you had. You know, you're going to develop a relationship that oftentimes is far better than anything you could ever imagine if you're actually willing to do the work.
And accept that you're going to mature and get older. And
oh, yeah.
So is your partner.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the relationships I had in my 20s are, yeah, they were so superficial, right? The things I was looking for, you know, it's how somebody looks and it's, you know, how great intimacy is. And ultimately those things, as you get older, I think your values change. And I think what's important to you changes. And if you can have a life partner where you know your roles and you see the best in each other, you're willing to forgive each other, and you're willing to work together and compromise and be a team, you know, it's that we're a team. You know, we're a team. We function as a team. And no matter what, I see the best in you. And we work together, you know. And marriages, you have to make sacrifices. You know, you have to be willing to make sacrifices and recognize that, you know, you don't always have all the answers, you know. And oftentimes the things that we might react to the most inside of our marriage, oftentimes we'll find that our spouse is actually pretty accurate, right? Because they're with us, they know us, and it can be a hard pill to swallow and hard to accept, but, you know, if we can really truly work as a team, we can work through anything.
Therapy is a great thing for marriages, isn't it? Helping each other understand your partner.
Yeah, I think that the therapeutic system, in a lot of ways, is great. But I think that part of the problem I have with therapy and working in the clinical field for as long as I did, I kind of saw how broken the system was. And, you know, you have the DSM-5, you have what constitutes medical necessity, you know, you have, you know, therapy, they're big on ethics and boundaries, and you're taught to not self-disclose. And I think therapy is an amazing place to start. And for some people, an amazing place to end too. Even having just a willingness to look inside yourself. But, you know, I think there's kind of this gatekeeping effect that happens with psychologists and, you know, psychiatrists and LMFTs and marriage and family therapy. I think if we worked harder to democratize the tools to the people, I think people would really see their sense of agency and self-efficacy and realize this model of dependency that therapy is built on, right? I have to go to you. It would really fall apart when people realize that they have the capability. And I saw that for so many years as, you know, clinicians treating clients like they were incompetent, you know, and really limiting the client on what the client could achieve by not giving the client what they needed, you know, the right tools, the right information, the right structure, the accountability, I think is so important. And I think, you know, having a roadmap to get there is critical.
I'm sure you see a lot of very intelligent people choosing the wrong partners over and over again.
Oh yeah.
What is that? Yeah. Is that just like trying to heal your childhood wounds?
Yeah, there's a concept in psychology, it's called repetition compulsion. And it's basically where you unconsciously recreate the same dynamic from your past in an attempt to tie up loose ends.
You can heal these things over time?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially once you realize that you're actually doing it. Like, for example, maybe a woman that grew up with a father who was an alcoholic and now she's in a marriage with an alcoholic, right? It's the most common example that we see, right? But these examples are, you know, a guy that he grew up in an environment with emotionally unavailable, you know, people, and he seeks connection and attachment with an emotionally unavailable woman, right? And he wants to get this connection and attachment with her. Why? So that he can finally feel like he's enough, right? If I can just secure this connection, then I can resolve, right, what occurred in the past. And that is happening on a subconscious level with people all the time. And I think healthy relationships push us out of our comfort zone. And I think where we're most comfortable, if we see these patterns reoccurring and we find ourselves kind of feeling comfortable again, well, we should really start to question that. Because, you know, what is what is predictable is what's familiar. What's familiar is what we know. What we know feels safe, right? Even if it's the very thing that's really hurting you and destroying your life.
Courage is an underrated quality.
Yeah, and courage cannot exist in the absence of fear. So in order to have courage, you got to be afraid. And that is really one of the biggest pieces is the willingness to walk through fear. It's not allowing your emotions to dictate your actions. You know, there's a cognitive distortion that's called emotional reasoning. And it's when you feel something and you use the feeling that you have as a fact of reality, right? I feel guilty, so I must have done something wrong. I feel afraid, so something bad must be happening. And I think it's our willingness to really challenge that. Hey, I feel fear, but I'm going to get out of, I'm going to have this hard conversation anyways. I'm going to tell the truth. Or I feel fear, but you know what? I'm going to ask for help, or I'm going to raise my hand, or I'm going to share this. I feel really ashamed and embarrassed about this, but I'm going to bring it out to the light anyways. That is how we grow. That is how we grow. It's our willingness to face our fear and be courageous, like you shared.
And having the ability to tolerate risk.
Yeah.
Super important too.
Yeah.
A lot of people will choose a safe partner.
Yes.
And a safe partner eventually leads to a boring relationship.
Yes. Yeah. The risk part is huge because, you're taking healthy risks, right? I see a lot of guys there, they'll say, well, you know, I'm scared to share this because I don't know how my wife will react. And there's been guys who have, been through traumatic things like being sexually abused, or they've been through things that their wives have no idea about, and maybe there's an intimacy issue with him, or maybe there's some type of problem in the marriage, and there's vital information to understanding the pattern and the cycle that, his partner is not even aware of. So, that those missing pieces are so critical to building and sustaining something healthy. We got to know about our partner.
What are the steps that you take in order to start rebuilding a marriage in trouble?
The very first step is clarity. So clarity is the very first step. I have to develop a level of clarity about my core beliefs, right? About my attachment patterns. If I don't have clarity, then I'm not going to be able to solve anything. So clarity is the very first step. Yeah, we put people through what we call our clarity compass, which is it's the system of basically diagnostic tools that we use to create a comprehensive report. So when somebody comes in right away, they can get that clarity right out the gate so that they can feel secure in the sense, okay, now I know what my problem is. And now I can see it very clearly how these patterns are playing out in my life across these different domains, right? And once you can have that clarity, then it's, okay, now what do I do about it? And that, it's very difficult in therapy sometimes because, therapists aren't allowed to necessarily kind of give you the clarity. They have to kind of guide you through your own introspective journey to discover those answers on your own, right? Well, why do you feel like you do that? Or, it's posed with a lot of questions that are designed to help you kind of introspect and self-reflect, which is great. But, you can't solve the problem with the same mindset that created it. So a lot of times you can get lost in that journey, and it could take you maybe, sometimes up to a year to develop that clarity. So clarity is the very first step.
And then after that?
Your identity. So really looking at your identity. Who am I? Who do I believe I am, right? And really looking at your identity, right? Who are you? And I think that a lot of people's identity is, when they're struggling, is shame-based. And there's a lot of shame there. And they maybe pride themselves on things in the external, where hey, I'm a business owner, and I'm a father, and I'm an entrepreneur, and I'm this person, but is that really who you are, right? Or is that what you do? So developing a healthy identity is key. For me personally, I believe that begins with God. I believe that starts with understanding, really your relationship with God and who God says you are. And once you can start with a good foundation of your identity, right? Then you can start to build on that, because it, like I said, it's the be do have, right? So it's who do I need to be so I can do these things, so I can have this life that I want? It's about being and becoming. So the identity is foundational to showing up in a relationship and in any area of life in at the most in the most optimal way, in the most functional state that I can be in.
There's been a lot of changes and evolution with men in the last decade or two, right?
Oh yeah,
we're raising a whole different breed of man than we did 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's inevitable. Yeah, I think it's inevitable. And I see a lot of young men getting trapped on social media. Video games is a big one. And I think a common trap that guys, young men get stuck in, I know I did, is, you know, if you don't have healthy male role models, you can oftentimes look towards unhealthy kind of exaggerated versions of masculinity, right? That can lead you down the path to assuming that all these things in the external, right? If you just appear to be this person. And that's where the mask really develops. You know, the mask, the bravado mask, the I'm fine mask, the perfectionist mask, I have the answer to every problem mask. And those masks can make the authentic version of you become invisible. You know, once those walls come down and those masks come off, you know, and the performance ends, that's when people really are able to face the truth of, you know, who am I in my identity beyond just who I portray myself to be? I do this exercise with guys where I have them write, you know, what they portray, and then on the inside, what they hide. And then on the back is designed for other people to write on what other people see in you, and other people fill that part out. And the dichotomy between those three parts is amazing. It's fascinating because what people portray is oftentimes completely the inverse of what they hide. You know,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
Would you say most of the relationships you see are? Do you have a lot of hope for the relationships you see?
Yeah, I'm kind of an eternal optimist. Like I see the best in people no matter what. Yeah, and I think that's very important. You know, even when I see people struggle, I see the best in them, and I think that comes from I think people seeing the best in me when I was at my worst. And I don't think that anybody's too far gone, you know, from changing and having hope. So when I see couples struggle, or I see, you know, men struggle and there's a divorce occurring and they think their life is over, I always have hope, because your situation can change so dramatically in such a short period of time. You know, not to be held down by what happened to you, but to be moved by what you can do with it, you know, and how many people's lives you can actually impact and change just from your story alone. I mean, for me, that was where a lot of my passion and the mission and what we do with Beyond Driven is now was birthed out of, you know, it's the power of the capability that you have as a human being in your spirit, you know, the resolve that I think every one of us has. It's just about whether or not we're willing to tap into that, you know. And if we just set ourselves on a path, you know, the path to transformation isn't paved on a road of self-condemnation, you know, beating myself up and always overanalyzing what I'm doing and where I'm messing up. You know, it's paved on a road of self-compassion, self-forgiveness. And if we can have that type of relationship with ourselves, we give ourselves room to grow. So I always have hope when I see people, no matter where they're at. I always have hope to know that I know God can do anything with anyone at any time. And I think that it's exciting to be a part of that with people. I never looked at it as a job. I always just kind of looked at it as it's my purpose.
Are you married?
Yeah.
You are?
Yeah, I'm happily married with two kids.
Good for you.
Yeah.
That's important in your position, right?
Yeah.
If you weren't married, you'd be like...
Yeah, and our story wasn't the normal story either, you know? I was... the situation that I was in with my wife and the situation she was in prior to us getting married. I mean, that's the beautiful part is when you have a marriage and you put God at the center and you're really willing to work on these problems, amazing things can happen. And the individual that you entered that relationship as is going to be vastly different than the individual that you will be 5-10 years from then if you're willing to grow with your partner. And I think that is a big piece is, do you have a partner who has a fixed mindset or a growth mindset? Do they think they have nothing to work on? Yeah, I don't have no problems. I don't have anything to work on. I don't need to look at my childhood. I already know what to do. You know, or do you have somebody that says, hey, you know what? Yeah, let's do that. Let's work on this. Let's read this book together. Let's join this program together. Let's go to this seminar together. Let's invest in our marriage so that we can have the healthiest marriage we can.
What are the qualities you see in a partner, male or female, that helps the recovery process happen? Because there are some people who are just too difficult to
fallibility. Work. Yeah. That they're willing to admit that they're fallible. So humility, that they're humble. I think the number one toxic trait of someone in a relationship is infallibility, that I'm infallible, that I have no problems, that I have nothing to work on, that it's you. You know, you're the problem here. You're the one that needs to fix this. You're the one that causes these problems. And, you know, I see a lot of guys that come from very, very healthy environments. And those are the guys that are always the most susceptible to the most toxic situations because they're so naive, right, to the toxicity. They didn't grow up with manipulation. They grew up where trust, honesty, respect, like these are virtues and relationships that were upheld to the highest, right, regard. So I see a lot of guys, they want to do what's honorable. They want to do what's noble. They want to do what's right. They believe in this, the covenant of marriage, and they believe in upholding their vows and being committed to their partner. And they're willing to continue to go down that road after there's been infidelity, after there's been, betrayal after betrayal, after having a partner that's unwilling to work on it. And I think the same thing applies, you know, for women it's very similar. And I think that can be really hard because people don't want to give up on, you know, situations that they've invested a lot of time and energy into. And, but if you really look at it, you know, did you really give up on the relationship if you have a partner who's not willing to work on it, you know, or did they?
Tim, what would you say is the most important lesson you've learned in doing this work you do?
That people's behavior is not random, that there's a pattern and there's always a sequence and there's always a reason. And, if you ever want to understand why you do what you do, you just have to look at the pattern. And when you look at the pattern, you're able to really see how that pattern plays out in all different domains of your life. So I'd say the number one thing is I think that people think that these things happen randomly and they're a result of what's happening externally, but, you know, every external problem can be directly correlated with an internal one. And I think if we have the willingness to look inside ourselves and find those answers, and once we do find those answers and make sense of it, take the necessary steps to get uncomfortable to change it, anything is possible. Anything is possible.
Excellent. All right. Tim Arrigo, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on relationships. Where can people find you on social media?
You could find me on Beyond Driven on Instagram, on Facebook. Same with YouTube, Beyond Driven.
Cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
Thank you.